Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of the Op-Ed Page with me, Elisa Kemmerer Page. It's my weekly look at everything that's catching my eye, piquing my interest, and causing me to dig a little deeper across the worlds of technology, politics, pop culture, pandemics, activism, all over the place. So this week, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the news that's been going around about taxes. Super exciting topic, and sort of like the minimum wage, I'm like diving in with these easy peasy, no one disagrees topics. But there was some scuttlebutt this last week or two around a report about how much the richest billionaires in the country pay or do not pay in taxes, and how they should or should not be charged for taxes. And so I'm going to weigh in a little bit and point you to some writers and thinkers and podcasts that I've been listening to around that topic. I'm also going to briefly talk about how exactly, as part of my origin story, how exactly did I transition from commodities to tech some 20-something years ago? And, you know, the lessons I learned from making that big career shift. And then finally, as always, quick takes. And I have some stuff to talk about. So sit back, relax, and let's get started. As mentioned, I'm going to kick off with that easy peasy, non-controversial topic of taxes. ProPublica put out an article, which I'll link to, of course, in the show notes, talking about the true income tax rate that some billionaires pay. They were anonymously provided with a trove of IRS data, just raw data. I heard them on a podcast with Kara Swisher, which I'll also provide the link to, where they talked a little bit about how they validated it, how they made sure it was accurate, how they, you know, checked it out, but and that it was so much raw data, it took a very long time to even figure out what's in here and what's the story here. What they ended up making the story was the fact that they hand selected, they had thousands of people's, rich people's, I guess, tax data, but they hand selected five or six famous billionaires, Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, one of the Koch brothers, and so on. And they looked at how much they paid in taxes. Oh, Bill Gates was one. And the thing they did was they said, okay, the federal income tax system is based on income, like it's in the name. And the key thing to know is that these guys operate outside that system. Like a lot of these guys will take a dollar in salary. That's their quote unquote income. But they operate outside that system, not only because a lot of their net worth and wealth is tied up in unrealized gains. In other words, millions of shares of their company that they haven't sold yet, and assets of other kinds, but also because they can borrow against this net worth. So this was something I learned about in the Kara Swisher podcast that I didn't really think through. I knew this was something Donald Trump or real estate developers in general can do, which is that they can write off. They don't have to pay income tax on properties the first 10 years after development. There's this kind of offsetting. I mean, there's this, you know, accommodation for how costly it is to build. And so that real estate developers often make sure that as soon as one property is ready to roll into actually having to pay taxes, they make sure they are developing other properties that have, you know, can provide deductions that offset so that they never really pay taxes because they're always just building the next thing. And so they're always just rolling that over. So I knew about that. What I didn't know is that when these super rich billionaire folks, if they actually need cash for something, they take out debt on using their assets as collateral, or basically based on the assets they have that they're not paying taxes on. And then they can even deduct the interest expenses of their debt. And so it's better than not paying taxes. They're even getting a further deduction out of it. And that was like, that kind of blew my mind a little bit. So they can choose when to have income or not have income, because they don't, you know, in my household, we have some stock. And when we have had big expenses come up, we have sold stock to pay for that. And that's kind of, it's not great, because then you also are paying taxes that year. You've had some big expense, so you've sold taxes to pay for it, but you're going to owe taxes on the capital gains of what you sold. So you're going to have to come up with that at the end of the year. So it's a cycle you don't really want to have to get into, but that these guys don't have to, because they can just borrow against their assets and they can, you know, do debt management. All of this is legal. All of this is the system we have. No one is saying it's not. No one is saying it's not legal. No one is accusing them of doing anything. What the whole point was to say, but it's not okay. It is not healthy. It is not a good system. So ProPublica did something that said, well, what about if we took this idea of wealth tax, and how would we possibly measure that? And what would they really owe, or what effective tax rate have they really been paying? Because it's not, in some cases, yes, these guys didn't pay federal income tax. And this only looked at federal, by the way. But in some cases, they paid lots of federal income tax. It's just when you took into account their overall wealth, it was a drop in the bucket. And ProPublica looked at wealth growth. So basically, they said, in the absence of having income, because they can choose not to have income, how do you calculate what was the effective income? And that's like, how much did their wealth grow? How much did their net worth grow? And so I think they basically used Forbes, because every year Forbes does an analysis of the richest people and analyzes their net worth. And so they use the change from one year to the next in net worth to calculate what their kind of effective income was. And so they said, if we took this change in worth and said, okay, and this is how much they paid in taxes, what is their effective tax rate on their true income, is what they're calling it. And in those cases, all these guys, the ones that I heard them talk about were all guys. They all are paying like less than 1% or 1%, 2%, 3% was big. So that's their point, is that when it comes to how their money really works, it works outside our federal income tax system. So I have both seen on Twitter and LinkedIn and in person had conversations with guys, and so far they have all been guys, and they've all been white guys, I have to say, who are irate or very dismissive of this story, because all they want to focus on is that it's legal and it's just how we all operate with our stocks. We don't pay, if we hold stocks, we don't pay on the unrealized gains. We only pay taxes when we sell it. None of which anyone is disputing. Like, yeah, that's the way. Yes, understood. But they're very put out by this idea of a wealth tax. And in some cases, I'm just like, this is never going to be you at the levels that anyone in government or anyone in politics is talking about beginning a wealth tax. This is not you. And if it's you, congratulations, because you could not possibly spend this money in your lifetime. But anyway, it's not you. So thanks for being all up and being the defense lawyer for a bunch of guys who you're never going to get to be. But anyway, but the thing is, there are two things. When I was having this debate with a guy I know, and I was like, you know, because I used to work for a commodity trader, and when people had money under his management, they were charged two fees. They were charged what was called an incentive fee, which was a percentage of the gains that he got them. And they were charged an asset management fee. And this is not the only place in the financial industry where people charge asset management fees. I mean, it's a low percentage. It's like 1% or something, but it's a fee based on assets under management at a prescribed point in time. So somehow all these financial people figured out how to charge a fee based on net worth or assets under management, not income. Imagine that. But on this podcast, another example totally was brought up that I was like, why didn't I think of that? That how, you know, middle-class people pay a net worth tax every year, and I pay a shit ton in this, is property taxes. My house is an unrealized gain. My house could go through another housing recession like there was back in the aughts, you know, where the condo I bought as a single person, you know, after owning it for, I don't know, 7 years, was suddenly worth less than what I paid for it for a while. Now, I just held on. I was just planning to live there. So it appreciated and all was good. But there was no guarantee. This house has appreciated, but there's no guarantee. Until I sell it, there's no guaranteed gain here. And yet every year, there is a process by which someone assesses the value of this property and I pay a shit ton of taxes. And I would pay even more if it wasn't for Prop 13, which I hate, but you know, still I'm acknowledging that it has kept my taxes lower than they might have been. So that is a tax I'm paying on my wealth. You know, you hear people say they're house rich or house poor or whatever. And I never get what it means. Like, I think I'm house rich because I'm rich in house, but poor in cash. But I think people say it the other way, but I don't know. Anyway, that is a tax I pay on my net worth, and someone's assessing it. And other than those brief years during the recession, when I really do think the assessments went down, most of the time the assessments do not go down. There is no fluctuation based on the fluctuation of the, you know, and if anything, they go slightly up all the time. I feel like since I bought this house, which by now is almost 7 years ago, I think our property taxes have gone up every year. And like, there's, what am I doing about that? Nothing. Am I like all up in arms that someone is charging me taxes on something that is an unrealized gain? No, that is a wealth tax on not wealthy people. So I think we could figure it out, is the point. And I also think we could all stop being so worried about these billionaires and the ramifications it has for us. Because the ramifications it has for us, the most of us, for like 99.5% of us, is nothing. Like, if anything, better funded infrastructure, better funded schools, better funded a lot of things. And the other thing that I will link you to is Anand Giridharadas, who I mention a lot, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, because Warren Buffett is mentioned in this ProPublica, and he had like the lowest effective tax rate of all of them. And yet we think of him as the good billionaire, right? Because he is giving his, a lot of his money away, and he's like explicitly says, I should pay more in taxes. And again, he takes advantage of the system there is, and he doesn't. Like, I have a CPA, and I'm sure that she gets us whatever deductions we're entitled to and helps us pay less than we would if we did it on our own. That's the system we're in, and that's the system we operate in. And so people kind of think of him as, you know, oh, well, he's a good billionaire. And Anand makes the point that he's actually the worst of all, because he makes us feel like it's not a problem with the fundamental system. It's a problem with how some people act within it, when he thinks it's more, what is the system that allows people to hoard so much wealth? And because even Warren Buffett, and I'm actually so surprised Warren Buffett said this. I guess even Warren Buffett is quoted as saying that he thinks his money does more good when he directs it and philanthropically than it would just to pay down the national debt. And the ProPublica guy says, you know, something that we've all said at some point, which is, hey, I'd love to like earmark my tax payments too. So I can say, you know what? I don't want my taxes to go to the military. I don't want my taxes to go to this program or that program. You know, let me just tell you where my taxes would do the most good. Yeah, that'd be nice for all of us, wouldn't it? But that's not how it works. That is not how it works. So anyway, all of these things are really good food for thought. I feel like it's inevitable we are going to have to move towards some system that extracts more justice from those who have the most to give and changes the system. Again, the point is not that they did anything illegal. The point is that the system is bad. And I don't think the system was predictable, because you know what? this wealth issue, you know, 100 years ago, you just didn't have the same levels of disparity. And I think you probably also didn't have the same number of ways you could get out of paying taxes, if we're being honest. I'm all for, I don't know how, that's not my job, but it is clear there are ways you could figure out how to have a wealth tax or an assets under management tax or a net worth tax or whatever, in addition to income tax. And that would be the only fair way to deal with folks who are so wealthy that they can operate outside any system of needing income, and therefore not pay into the only system we have right now for collecting money from them to contribute to the society that allows them to be who they are and to build what they've built and have what they have. That's my story, and I am sticking to that one. So in last episode, I told the third part of my origin story, which is how I decided after 7 years unexpectedly spent in the commodities industry, I ended up looking around and deciding I should try to see if I could get into tech and see, figure out whether I liked it, figure out whether I had aptitude for it, figured out whether it liked me, which is a totally different question. And the reason, as I explained in last week's episode, is because the company I was working for decided to move offices, you know, miles and miles away without any thought for how that might impact employees. And I realized I didn't have very much job mobility working for an industry that was centered across the country in Chicago and New York. Whereas tech, obviously, was centered in Silicon Valley, where I lived. And the year was 1997, to date myself. And those were boom times. If you weren't around then, that was the dot-com boom. But in support of the dot-com boom, I mean, people think of the dot-com boom as being all about like pets.com and other internet companies. But Silicon Valley was also the leader in all the companies that built all the infrastructure to support the booming internet. So, you know, from semiconductor to networking equipment and routing and serving and all that kind of stuff, that was all happening here. When I decided that I wanted to go into that industry, you know, it's not like I had any tech background, didn't have an engineering degree, hadn't been working in tech. So first I did what I guess is just always lesson number one, which is I kind of put the word out and first of all, figured out where some of my friends were working, because I had a lot of friends at that time still through theater. I was still doing commodities during the day and theater at night. And most of my friendship community, because I worked in small companies, small offices, my friendship network were all theater people mostly. And so, you know, but most theater people in a place where it's not their nine to five, they have day jobs. They have whole other lives. And so, you know, I had to learn a little more about what some of my friends were doing and let them know that I was interested and that I was looking to make the leap. The second thing is that I had to decide, well, what exactly am I going to go for here? Clearly can't go for being, you know, on the development side. You know, I believe people can far exceed what they think they can do, that the stories you tell yourself about what you can't do probably aren't true. I also believe that most people who go to college for things 4 or 5 years later, they're doing things they never talked about in school because, especially in technology, things evolve so quickly. But, you know, there are limitations. So, and I, as I mentioned last week, I had been doing some marketing functions for my last company, even though that wasn't really my title. I, you know, created our pitch email or letter copy. I designed brochures. I designed a trade show booth. I went to trade shows and talked to customers. I figured out what we were going to do with these trade shows. I had done a lot of technical writing, making our documentation for our system. So, you know, I decided to sort of zero in on marketing / maybe writing / documentation, maybe, but somewhere in marketing. So here's the other thing. By now, in 1997, I'm 33, and by now I've been in one industry for 7 years, and I'm making okay money. Not great, but you know, fine. And I decided that I really needed to get my foot in a door and figure out if I wanted to stay in the room I entered more than I needed to exactly match any notions I had about what I should be doing or making. And, you know, it's like I have a healthy ego, but I also decided that my best shot was to get in very junior in a marketing department somewhere. So, so the thing is that a friend of mine worked for a hardware company and their VP of marketing was looking for an admin. And it doesn't hurt that an admin they had just gone public, but this was back in the day when a small company might still go public. So they only really had about 120, 150 employees, but they had gone public. And, it helps that a small public tech company hiring an admin isn't going to pay worse than a 7-person small business in a somewhat more niche industry. So it's not like I went in and took some massive pay cut, but I did take kind of a seniority level cut because I was literally coming in as the admin in this marketing department. And the VP of marketing, who was my first mentor in tech, you know, he said to me, "Don't you think you're kind of overqualified for this role? And why do you want to come in and do it?" And so I was just super honest. I just said, "I really want to, this is the sector I want to live here. This is my home. This is the sector that is most critical to this part, to where I live. But I don't have a background in it, so I don't expect to come in at a level that I might achieve if I hopped in the industry that I'm already in. I might be a little overqualified." I mean, and I think he meant overqualified like intellectually, or, you know, obviously I wasn't overqualified from tech experience point of view, but I think he meant age and just capabilities, general capabilities. And I actually said to him, "Look, I think you're right. And in a year, we might have to have a discussion about what I do next and how you can support me in that. But for the next year, I'm going to be the best admin you ever had." I mean, I was really, when I look back at it, I'm like, I was so cocky. but I literally said that to him: "For the next year, I'm going to be the best admin you ever had." And he hired me. So I give him a lot of credit. His name was John Dahlquist from the company Harmonic, which is still around. It used to be called Harmonic Lightwaves. And I give him a lot of credit for that. And I think that he may be related to that because back in the day, you know, Harmonic focused back in the day on cable operators and providing equipment for cable operators to get you your cable TV. And back then it was mostly fiber optics. So this was pre-digital taking over how your cable channels were transmitted to you. And in fact, I was at Harmonic while they made that transition into the brand new digital product line. And back in the day, cable was an industry in which a lot of people started out climbing the poles, doing the installs, being super feet on the street, and then worked their way up. It was a very family-run kind of business. If you look at it, you know, the Roberts ran Comcast, which at the time was this small upstart in Philadelphia. The Dolan family ran Cablevision. I mean, there were like families behind a lot of the big cable operators, or, you know, big now, big at the time, but there's been a lot of shakeup there. And so I think maybe he just related to that concept of me coming in, starting my way, how to succeed in business without really trying, start my way in the mailroom and then working my way up. I think he may have related to that. It's so funny because we also kind of figured out in the interview that politically we had kind of very different views, and we like had this little mini political conversation very early on. And it really is striking to me that for all the years before 9/11, he could be this super Republican conservative guy and I could be me, and we could have lively debate, but lively friendly debate. And after 9/11, that's when things really changed in the ability to do that. That is another story for another time. But anyway, so he hired me. And I really was the best admin you could possibly have. I was super efficient. I was super dedicated. I was super accurate and detail oriented. I did everything that one should do. And I started kind of pitching in and helping because he oversaw marketing, product marketing, and marketing communications. So, I started pitching in where I could help with the MarCom team or with the product management team and just taking on little tasks and, figuring out how I could contribute. And listen, I had been working, first of all, I had moved from New York where I had been very paycheck to paycheck, making very little money, having no benefits, I used to use Planned Parenthood when I came home for Christmas, as my healthcare. Then I was working in these small commodities offices, again, no benefits. I think I signed up for Kaiser and paid myself, just to have something a little later in that 7-year stint, small offices, no sodas in the fridge, no office parties. Like we were small. One was a one man shop. The other was like 5 or 6 people. So now I go into this company that has a headquarters in Sunnyvale and has health benefits and has a fancy office building with a lunch, subsidized lunch that came in every day. And I don't know. I remember someone told me when you go interview at tech companies, I think this is still good advice today. Go use the bathroom while you're there and find out if they have feminine supplies in the bathroom, because given how male dominated tech was and still is, that's like a sign to you whether anybody is kind of thinking about things outside their own white maleness at the company. And so, sure enough, I did that while I was at Harmonic, and sure enough, they had supplies in there. And I was like, okay, one criteria down. I still think that's pretty good advice today, honestly. Anyway, so, I was pretty happy. I had a cubicle and I had my, it was a big shift. It felt more grown up. It felt more professional. It felt more like it had promise. So I was pretty happy. And the team was really great. I still talk to multiple members of that team today. Anyway, so I can talk more about what I did with these companies in the cable industry next time. But I really want to extract a couple things from this. And the first is that I didn't walk in with preconceived notions about who I had to be and what it had to look like, because I knew I wanted something. I wanted to figure out, I wanted to get experience. I wanted to figure out if I liked something. I wanted that getting the foot in the door. It doesn't just have to apply when you're coming out of college or something. I was 33 years old and did the same thing. I could do the same thing again. I didn't get hung up. Now that may speak to me and what is important to me, what I value most. You may have different things you value. And certainly I value things differently today, 20 years down the line, than I did then. And I have different requirements. But I think sometimes people get very linear. They get very stuck in thinking about their careers in a linear way. And that doesn't always have to be the case. And the other thing is that I think people in that same feeling of linear, you have to go in one direction and you have to kind of be just on a constant sloping upwards trajectory where nothing impedes you. But life isn't like that. Life is also not a one-way expressway with no exits, no ability to U-turn, no left turns, no right turns. You can anytime stop, take a turn, turn around and go another way. If you make a choice and you don't think it was the right one, you can choose something else. I think people get super hung up, and I know people to this day who get super hung up on saying, well, I really want to stay there a year. And I'm like, if in 2 months you're miserable, I just don't think that's necessary anymore. Maybe in, you know, I mentioned how to succeed in business without really trying. Hey, maybe in the 60s, maybe back in the day when, you know, when you got a job, if you wanted to stay for life, you probably could stay for life, or you probably had a pension, or you probably had all sorts of things to encourage you to stay in one place and just climb that ladder or do whatever it is you wanted to do there. That is not the world, the working world we live in anymore. And you do not have to give someone, you do not have to give someone a year of your life because you thought something would work out if it didn't. I just wish more people could realize that. And when looking at resumes and when I look at people's backgrounds, okay, sure. If someone has hopped around every year for 10 years, I might be like, huh, what's that story? But if it's happened once or twice during their career, I think nothing of it, literally nothing of it. Like, things happen, you make choices, they don't go right. And companies are a lot more volatile these days. So things happen, companies, you know, they change direction and all of a sudden they're reorging out hundreds of people who were great at their jobs, but that is what happens. So I just went in with the perspective that I want to try this. I want to see if it likes me and I like it. And if I do like it and I'm great, things will happen. I can make things happen. And that is what ended up happening, but it required not being hung up on title, not being hung up on, making more money than I had in the last place. In a way I effectively did because I now had all these benefits. I could cancel my health insurance that I was paying for privately, you know, all sorts of things, right? I got stock options, which helped me buy a car, stuff like that. So, you know, I had to sort of detach myself from thinking now, you know, that I wanted change. And that meant I had to give something to get that change. And if I had decided I was wrong, the third thing I will say is that I decided not to worry about it on day one. What happens if I'm wrong? You know, and I think that's what we a lot of times do, which is that we try to solve the problem that hasn't happened yet. And we think we're being forward thinking, but all we're really doing is taking too much mental bandwidth and applying it to something that isn't happening, that we don't know will happen, that we probably control whether it happens or not. And instead of giving that mental bandwidth to the task at hand. So yeah, your career doesn't have to be linear, that you can try something and if you don't like it, you can stop it. And you don't have to solve a problem for a year or two from now before it's even clear it's a problem. And just, you know, stay in the moment where you are and see how it goes. I think a whole lot more of us could benefit from playing things way more by ear than we do. Anyway, that's Origin Story Part 4, the transition from commodities into technology. And now we come to the portion of the show I call Quick Takes. Just today, particularly, super quick romp through some of the things I've been reading, listening to, watching, etc. As always, I want to point you to my latest newsletter. I talked about a panel I was on last week where the moderator asked me about a stat in a Washington Post article that said that 83% or so of CEOs want workers to come back to the office full time, but only a little more than 10% of employees want to. And she asked me, how does one account for such a discrepancy? In the moment, I came back with a bit of a cheap shot and said, well, how does one account for the discrepancy between CEO pay and average worker pay in this country? But I also got serious and brought up a few things. And the first thing was that that's a huge communications gap. What CEO even goes on record saying something that is so out of step with what their employees think? Not just because how bad it makes them look to people who, you know, or outside their company, but how bad it makes them look to their employees. This is just a communications gap I can't even imagine. And then the second is, and more importantly, is it's such an empathy gap. And I just imagined workers looking at the CEOs and saying, this is the thanks we get for what we've been through. the last 15 months and yet kept this company going, great. I mean, this is why we're going to have a huge amount of people switching and trying new things and going off. And I think we're going to see huge turnover. But anyway, I talk about it more in my newsletter. I'll give you the link. I also want to tell you about, I signed up thanks to my friend Olivia, who knows I'm a musical theater nerd. She sent me this Stanford continuing education course that she saw that she thought I would be interested in. And it was a 4 by Sondheim, my favorite composer. You know, it was a 4-week Saturday course that looked at 4 different shows by Sondheim, Company, Follies, Sweeney Todd, and Sunday in the Park with George. And those latter two are probably amongst my top 5 musicals of all time. Sweeney Todd is probably still my favorite musical of all time. And, you know, she just thought I would be interested in, and you know, we were in high pandemic mode, and I just thought, what the hell else am I doing on Saturdays? Not like I'm going out and having brunch. So I signed up, and it was, I don't know, $130. It was not, maybe it was a little more. I don't remember. It was not wildly expensive. It may be $200. I don't know, but it was, each class was 2.5 hours. So I thought, you know, to pay some musicologist, some expert, $20 or $30 an hour to teach me deeper things about these shows that I really loved. And when I was going nowhere and spending no money doing anything else, seemed reasonable to me. And to be clear, I've never done something like that before. I've never taken a continuing education course. I've never, you know, I was happy to be out of school. I've talked many times about being the unmotivated student. So this is not natural for me. Anyway, I just would urge all of you to think about if there's anything you're just interested in and love that you would like to learn more about and take courses like this. I mean, I'm probably for some of you, Lisa. Yes, people take courses and people do things to learn. And I knew that. I mean, my mom, when she finally did retire at age 70, she joined immediately this online learning, not online learning, I forget, but an ongoing learning group. She joined a group. And she and my stepdad would go to Santa Clara University and take these courses. And it was designed for seniors, but they took courses on brain science. They took courses on ancient Rome. I mean, all sorts of things. So yes, of course, I knew people take courses, but I had never taken a course. And I thought it was really fun and interesting. And you know, it would be alternate between telling stories about the background of producing the show, analyzing the music and the lyrics, playing stretches of the show, either soundtracks or finding video. The teacher found video of it. And, you know, it was a great experience. I recommend it. I'm going to share a link to, if you don't subscribe to Dan Rather's newsletter, like, yes, Mr. CBS, Dan Rather, you really should, because he's awesome. I mean, he just says it. He has opinion now, which as a reporter, I'm not sure he ever felt that was his role. And he has opinion and analysis, but he also has like this hope and optimism that's cute. Like, and that I wish I maybe shared more with him, which is why I need to read him. But he has a great newsletter about why the media focuses so heavily on Joe Manchin instead of going after all the Republican senators, that Joe Manchin is supposedly the one man who can stop them, and that he gets quizzed about why he won't budge on the filibuster instead of all those people being quizzed about why they won't do things that used to be considered nonpartisan, why they won't do things that their constituents agree with. He says it better than I can, but he is really, it's the same problem that the media has been really struggling under since the Republican Party became so radicalized 5 years ago. They don't know how to deal with it. And so they don't deal with it. And he explains that really well. So I'm going to leave that link. I really recommend it. I have two things I watched that I really want to recommend. The first, I'm sure you've maybe heard about. It's on Netflix. It's called High on the Hog. It is an exploration of how African American cuisine influenced American cuisine, or how it is American cuisine. And first of all, it's beautiful. I mean, it's just beautifully shot, and it's just so it's tactile almost. You can, your senses, even though all you're doing is watching, you feel like you can smell and taste the food. You feel like you can feel the heat or feel the sand. I mean, it's just very rich looking, and that just makes it seem like it's a sensory experience. Two, it's got important historical context, things you may never have known unless you really have studied a lot. Certain things we certainly weren't taught in school. And especially the first episode is set in Benin in West Africa, which was sort of a gateway for most of the slave ships where they embarked from to make the passage. And so there's a sense of history that you're learning. And through the context of food, it's really, you know, it's an interesting and I think relatively new take on understanding the impact of the system of slavery. It is, takes you into pockets of America that you may not know. And it also introduces you to all these people and how the impact. It's something I'm really interested in lately, and I talked about it last week in regard to the housing crisis, was how racist and segregation policies of the past continue to have their effects felt today. And so it deals with some of that. But this is all in the context of just, you know, if you liked CNN's Stanley Tucci in Italy series, you've got the same kind of digging into how people are creating and sharing and savoring the food in different areas of the world and of the country. And it's got that same kind of feeling. And I'll be honest, like a lot of the food is not food I eat. Like I'm a vegan. So this is not necessarily same as with the Stanley Tucci show. I'm not going to eat most of the food they're talking about. But even if you're not going to eat it, if you can put that aside to appreciate what it means to the people making it, serving it, giving it, eating it, it's wonderful. So High on the Hog, totally recommend. And the other thing I will totally recommend, and something that really the pandemic created this whole other interest for me in the Marvel universe, because I was more of like, I'm nerdy in many ways, but I wasn't a comics nerd. I've never been a comics nerd. And I'm not an action movie nerd, right? So give me Star Wars for sure, and there's action in it, but like I perceived the most of the Marvel Universe movies to be like action movies, which was kind of wrong. I mean, I had seen some, you know, I went and saw Black Panther in the theater. I went and saw a couple of them, you know, but most of them I had never seen. So early in the pandemic, I probably mentioned that we watched all 23 Marvel Universe movies in order over probably a month, 5 weeks time. Like almost every night we sat down and watched the next one. And that kind of, and I just was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it. And so when Disney Plus started introducing these new Marvel-oriented series on Disney Plus, the first being WandaVision, which I loved, that just brought a whole different, like, a whole different activity to me. And Loki has started. I'm saying all of this as a preface to saying Loki has started and it's awesome. First of all, Tom Hiddleston as Loki. I mean, he's probably been the breakout, like Chris Hemsworth, maybe Thor, but Loki was sort of the it boy from any Thor related movies. He's just got such a clever, interesting, unpredictable, character and performance. And the series just takes it in, this new series just takes it in a totally different direction. So you're not in the worlds of the Marvel universe that you've been in before. He's in this totally different scenario. And so it's intriguing because you don't feel like, big gods fight, big gods have battle. Loki acts like he's changed. Loki hasn't changed. Betrayal. But then something happens to like zip Loki out of the picture. Like, it's not that kind of story. It's super fun. Tom Hiddleston is great. Owen Wilson. I'm not a huge Owen Wilson person, but he's such an interesting presence in this Marvel universe, which is kind of unexpected. The two of them together are super fun. So I recommend Loki. They've only done two episodes so far, so it's plenty of time to catch up. And they're dropping them once a week with all three of the series, WandaVision, Falcon, and the Winter Soldier, and now Loki. They drop them once a week, so you have to relearn like the patience of not binging. Or you have to wait till they're only 6 or 7 week long seasons, so you could just wait and then watch them all at once. But yeah, Loki on Disney Plus. So that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. This podcast is found everywhere you listen to podcasts. So if you enjoyed what you heard, please do share. And if you haven't subscribed already, please subscribe. And I would really appreciate more ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google, wherever you're listening. They really help you find more listeners, and that would be great for me. So I would appreciate it. And you can come talk to me on social. I'm at Elisa C on Twitter. At Op-Ed Beige Podcast is the podcast Twitter feed. I'm at Elisa CP on Instagram. And my newsletter, elisacp.substack.com, operates like a blog in that you can go read my back. They're all public. You can go read my back posts and comment like it's a blog post. So I did not love Medium. None of my old blogs, they're all probably still alive on the internet somewhere. But so Substack is, I'm sort of treating it like a blog that I post one really significant amount of thinking on once a week. And I would love to hear from you in any of those formats. So have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. And in the meantime, get ready for that hot back summer.